BioCentury This Week is brought to you by Jato Capital, a global leading independent private equity fund dedicated to biopharma. Jato Capital has built a patient benefit-driven approach aimed at financing and accelerating the development of groundbreaking medical innovation. Jato's unique investment strategy combines significant capital and expert support to companies and their management teams, ranging from clinical development to market access for cutting-edge innovations with one main objective: go faster for the patient. Learn more at jato.life.
Welcome to BioCentury This Week, the podcast with BioCentury's editorial team talking drug development, policy, and financing for the biopharma space. I'm Jeff Cranmer, executive editor here at BioCentury, and joining me today are my colleagues,
Steve Austin, Washington editor,
Lauren Martz, executive director of Biopharma Intelligence,
and Stephen Hansen, director of Biopharma Intelligence.
On today's podcast, a drive-by analysis of accelerated approval is intellectual malpractice. Steve discusses his editor's commentary on accelerated approval. Support by FDA's ODAC for a myeloma metric makes the broader case for endpoint innovation. And what three companies' decision to delist from AIM says about life on the London Exchange for development stage biotechs. And we'll take a look at the launch of a very well-funded obesity company. Steve, last week in an op-ed, you wrote that academic opponents of accelerated approval have released yet another misleading paper, this time creating the false impression that about half of the cancer drugs granted accelerated approval turn out to be useless. Your piece has garnered quite a bit of attention among the biopharma folks on LinkedIn, including from rare disease advocates such as Michelle Lorenz, who is a big ALS patient advocate, and many, many others. Steve, what's going on here?
So the study looked at cancer drugs that received accelerated approval from 2013 to 2017, and it concluded that 41% did not improve overall survival or quality of life in confirmatory trials after more than 5 years of follow-up, and the results weren't available for another 15%. And then among the drugs that were converted to regular approval, 60% of the conversions relied on surrogate measures. And it made statements like, quote, although accelerated approval can be useful, some cancer drugs do not end up demonstrating benefit in extending patients' lives or improving their quality of life. So a lot of people read this. In fact, most journalists and a lot of medical journals read this, and they thought, wow, this is startling. You know, half of these drugs are useless, basically. The way the data was described led medical journals to publish stories with headlines like, most cancer drugs granted accelerated approval fail confirmatory trials. And fast-track drugs often do not improve clinical outcomes. Some biopharma trade publications had headlines like, most cancer drugs granted accelerated approval do not show improved survival, or nearly half of cancer drugs granted accelerated approval didn't end up showing clinical benefit. And I looked at all that and I thought, you know, that would really be startling and disturbing if it was true. But when you read the study and you think about it a little bit, it's a complete misrepresentation of the data and the facts. As I wrote in my commentary, which is open access, it's in front of the paywall, so anybody can read it. You wouldn't know it from reading the JAMA paper or the stories that are written about it, but there's a world of difference between the finding that an overall survival benefit wasn't demonstrated in confirmatory trials and concluding that a drug doesn't confer clinical benefit. It's basically like the old saying, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. And I looked at the paper and I quickly saw that many of the drugs that were listed in the supplement as examples of drugs that didn't demonstrate clinical benefit, in fact, there's no way that they could have. And I think the key takeaway from the whole thing is that overall survival isn't the only way to demonstrate clinical benefit for a cancer drug that's received accelerated approval. And in many cases, it isn't the best way to do it.
So, Steve, you know, why would it be that FDA wouldn't, you know, ask for overall survival as the confirmatory endpoint? I mean, what are some of the other options that they're, you know, willing to look at?
there's two things. One is, why wouldn't they necessarily require overall survival? And two, what are the other options? Okay. One of the reasons why they wouldn't require overall survival is because very often drugs that receive accelerated approval, the confirmatory trials are crossover designs. So it's a drug that seems to be highly effective compared to standard of care. Patients aren't willing to just line up and say, okay, well, half of us are going to get something that seems to be more effective than standard of care, and half of us will get standard of care, and we'll just see who lives longer. I mean, you go first if you want to sign up for that trial. Most people aren't going to do it, right? So the way that the trials are designed is that the patients who receive standard of care have an option at some point to cross over to receive the more effective therapy. And in doing that, you can demonstrate effectiveness, but you can't necessarily demonstrate overall survival because everybody gets the drug that you're studying. There are other reasons why you might not use overall survival. One is because in some cases, progression-free survival is actually a meaningful clinical benefit. Not in all cases, but there are cases where that's the case. I think Lauren's going to talk later on the podcast about multiple myeloma. At the recent advisory committee on multiple myeloma endpoints, Rick Pastor, the director of the Oncology Center of Excellence, mentioned that 17 drugs have been approved, I think, since 2003 to treat multiple myeloma. They've received accelerated approval. None of them has been approved based on an overall survival endpoint. I think all of them have been approved based on progression-free survival. And collectively, they've increased the survival in the disease from 2 years to 10 years. So it's a massive win for patients, and it's not based on demonstrating overall survival.
So, Steve, what about some of these accelerated approvals that we've seen in recent years for DMD, for Alzheimer's? How do they fit into this?
You know, I think that's a different story. You know, this paper was about cancer accelerated approval. My message also is not that all drugs that receive accelerated approval should receive full approval or that they're all fantastic drugs. Many of them are, some of them are not. But the point is that you can't just tot up the numbers, right? You can't just create a spreadsheet and say, oh, these ones didn't demonstrate overall survival, so therefore they're useless. You have to look at them drug by drug and look at the clinical context and make a decision, or somebody has to make a decision. FDA has to make that decision. People can second guess them, or they can look at it and see whether they agree with it as to whether these particular drugs actually have had their clinical benefit demonstrated. I think the other thing is the whole point of accelerated approval isn't perfection. It's to allow risk-taking when there's evidence that a therapy is reasonably likely to benefit patients who are suffering from a serious condition. And then after the drug gets on the market, to figure out whether the data that was promising enough to give it accelerated approval turns out to be right. And the goal should be to get that data as quickly as possible. In some cases, you're going to do it by demonstrating overall survival. In some cases, it's going to be another endpoint. And in some cases, it's going to turn out that, unfortunately, the promise wasn't real. And then FDA is going to have to withdraw the drug.
All right. Well, as Steve said, this is in front of the paywall. You'll find a link in the show notes. Okay. As Steve said, Lauren tuned in to last week's FDA advisory panel backing minimal residual disease, MRD, as an accelerated approval endpoint for multiple myeloma. Lauren, why is this important?
Thanks, Jeff. I think it's important because it's just an example of how essential endpoint innovation is for advancing new therapeutic mechanisms and continuing to expand the clinical benefit of drugs. What was needed in the case of multiple myeloma, especially frontline treatment of multiple myeloma, treating newly diagnosed patients, is a way to better refine clinical benefit in those patients. So what we've seen in this indication is, as Steve mentioned, is that the treatments have continued to get better over the years. Over the past 10 years, the survival has dramatically extended. That means that it's harder to differentiate therapeutic efficacy in a clinical trial versus the standard of care. So what we heard during the meeting is that standard of care in frontline, it's a combination of often three different mechanisms. It approaches 100%. So for companies to prove that they have a new therapy that could replace standard of care and be more effective in that setting based on objective response rates. Sorry, that's the 100% response rates that I was talking about, would be very difficult. So the other problem there is that having an objective response doesn't mean that you're, you know, being cured of your disease. There are other ways to better predict whether those responses are going to be durable and how a patient is going to fare in the longer term. And one of those ways is by detecting minimal residual disease, you know, taking a bone marrow sample and determining if you're able to detect cancer cells or signs of cancer cells above a certain threshold.
So the interesting thing to me is that it seems like this could be used then to figure out which drugs and which combination of drugs should go early and hopefully first line, so that you might actually be able to, what some of the people at the advisory committee said, you might even be able to come up with cures, or you might be able to come up with much longer duration remissions by using a different endpoint. That's really fascinating.
Exactly, because often the most innovative drugs are first tested in the later lines of treatment. And in multiple myeloma, there are now so many lines of treatment that these new drugs are being tested in patients who are very sick, who are, you know, potentially less likely to have a very strong, very favorable response. And if there's less incentive for companies, or if it's more difficult for companies to prove a benefit in earlier stage trials, some of these drugs aren't getting tested in the first line setting, where there were talks of, you know, maybe a cure already exists. Maybe something just hasn't been tested early enough to see if it could actually cure patients.
So do you think that companies are going to take up this endpoint, or is FDA going to require it going forward?
It's something that is often measured in clinical trials anyway. The problem with MRD as an endpoint and as a way to sort of assess prognosis after treatment is that it does require a bone marrow biopsy. So there was some talk about the need to innovate in the technologies that are used for MRD detection to possibly use a blood sample or a way to sort of get an easier understanding of where patients stand on MRD status, which I think would go a long way. But again, it's something that's already being used. And I do expect that companies will use this because, you know, you're talking about measuring an endpoint at 9 months or 12 months to predict longer term clinical outcomes. So that means trials could be dramatically shorter than if you're assessing progression-free survival.
Yeah. And I take the point that you said also, and you wrote in your story, that there's a hope that peripheral blood-based diagnostic tests are developed so that patients aren't going to need serial bone marrow biopsies, which is not something that anybody wants to go through.
Okay, the imminent departure of a trio of biotechs from London's AIM market is the most recent reminder that the exchange is not fit to fund development stage biotechs. Stephen, you spoke to CEOs at two of the companies, along with a prominent VC. What did you learn?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. To start off, I mean, this is, you know, this isn't exactly brand new, unfortunately, for the AIM market on the London Stock Exchange. It's sort of has a long history of being a place where companies can tend to get sort of drip fed. But I just thought that this recent spat of these three companies, you know, independent of each other, all kind of reaching the same decision that they are better off as private companies and being able to access capital than they are as a public company, was just kind of telling. Essentially, for the two CEOs that I spoke to, it really comes down to a lack of specialist investors available to invest on the public side, and really a lack of liquidity, you know, for those investors to be able to get in and out of stocks, and a lack of coverage by analysts. You know, there just aren't the banks and the specialist sort of knowledge analysts to be able to cover these stocks. And so I think there was just a lot of frustration from them. And, that, you know, when especially last year, sort of towards the end of the year, when we saw sort of the XBI start to run up, we saw a lot of the US names start to, you know, share prices start to come back up to where, you know, maybe they thought their valuation should be. And there just wasn't any of that on the AIM market. There was no sort of lifting, you know, unfortunately the tide didn't lift the AIM boats in this instance. And so I think, you know, when they were trying to raise money and struggling to get meetings with investors, struggling to speak to investors who, you know the space well, I think they felt that they were just better off, you know, going private.
Is there a differentiation between AIM and some of the other regional markets in Europe?
So there is to some degree, in that you have different sort of drivers for each of the markets. So some of the Scandinavian markets, there's much more of a, you can call it sort of either local hero effect, or there's more retail involvement where they're maybe more interested in the actual underlying science. So it's not to say that they're, you know, that AIM is a, I wouldn't say that AIM is a representative of each of the different European regional exchanges, but I think there are, in some ways, there also are some similarities, and particularly around, you know, not having a large number of big, deep-pocketed specialist investors, and the just the liquidity. You know, there just isn't the same breadth of trading to get in and out of these stocks. And so, yeah, I think that's been a challenge, and that is why to this day, you know, well, we've had this debate for 20 years about what does Europe need to do about its public market exchanges to sort of foster, you know, the sector. The answer has been, and I think continues to be NASDAQ. And I think that's sort of the case kind of going forward still to this day.
You know, some of the examples you cite of companies listed on AIM compared with like a peer that's listed on NASDAQ are really striking. Could you give us a couple of those examples?
Sure. Yeah. So two of the companies that have chosen to delist, one is C4X Discovery. They are a small molecule drug discovery company that focuses largely on oral small molecules against biologic targets, which is a pretty hot area, especially in immunology and inflammatory indications, right? And so they have a market cap of around 22 million pounds. And then you compare that to the likes of either Protagonist or, you know, Dice Therapeutics was acquired for over $2 billion a couple of years ago. Morphic has a, you know, market cap of around 1.4 billion. So you see some very clear links. And while, of course, C4X is much earlier, you know, still the disparity between those two valuations, I think, is remarkable. And then the other company, you know, that's chosen to delist, eTherapeutics, is developing RNAi platform. Also, again, preclinical, so earlier than some of these other companies. But I mean, just as a direct comparison, so Silence Therapeutics for years was a AIM-only listed company and was stuck with a valuation, I think, as recently as 2018. I think they had a valuation below $50 million. Went on, listed on NASDAQ, and they are now in the clinic and also developing an RNAi platform, and they're over a $1 billion company. And so I think it just goes to show that, you know, having access to those markets and that deep capital obviously is what really drives, you know, these companies. There are other success stories as well coming from AIM, you know, looking back at GW Pharmaceuticals or Verona Pharma. Those were also companies initially listed on AIM, went on to have success, but in each of those cases, they also listed on NASDAQ. And so I think for a development company, if you do want to list on AIM, you can, but I think you either have to have a quick exit plan or have a dual listing really to be able to get access to the capital that you need.
Yeah, I'm sure that Silence example will be very much in the mind of the CEOs that you spoke with. Okay, let's turn to a new obesity company backed by VCs at Arch and a team from the Medicines Company to the tune of $290 million. Metsera is developing a pipeline of obesity and metabolic disease drugs that the company believes will be differentiated due to its therapy's duration of effect, next generation targets, and combination approaches. Steven, $290 million, is that, that's got to be up there with the biggest rounds of the year, yeah?
It is, yeah, it's a lot. And it's, you know, from what I can tell from our database, it's, I believe, the largest venture round raised for a company that is focusing, you know, on obesity. So I think it kind of speaks to, you know, maybe the opportunity that they see there. You know, I think what'll be interesting, so they have, as you say, they have a pretty, what looks to be a pretty broad pipeline of, you know, GLP-1 combination therapies, some oral peptide-based, you know, technologies to develop oral therapies as well. So they're going after a lot of the same targets that Novo and Lilly are going after. So I'll be very curious to see, you know, what their vision is for the company. I mean, obviously, I know Arch likes to build big companies that can grow into be big players, but, you know, these are the two biggest companies in our sector right now that they're looking to take on. So I'll be curious to see if they really have a vision for building a pipeline that they can take them on directly, or if the idea is here is to basically build a pipeline that another big pharma could use to kind of fast track themselves into being competitive with those two.
So it's a big fat obesity company. When are they going to have their first drug on the menu?
It's a good question. I think they've already got one or two in the clinic. And so, you know, it'll be, I can't say off the top of my head when their first data is going to be expected to come. But, you know, I think people will be very keen to see what they're going to be able to show in the clinic when it comes to, you know, duration of effect or dosing intervals that they'll be able to do the therapies. You know, I think there's a lot of questions still about how they're looking to build a best-in-class portfolio here.
Yeah, and I see that Mubadala is one of the investors in this company. F Prime, let's see, GV, New Path, SoftBank, Vision Fund 2. And I was speaking to Ala Halawa at JP Morgan, and he teased that they were going to come up with a brand new obesity company from scratch that was going to look to take on Novo and Lilly. And I was a little skeptical when he said that at the time, but looks like they've assembled a really good team. Clive Meanwell, the CEO, he, of course, is the former medicines company CEO. And how big was that medicines company takeout back in the day, Stephen? Is that around 10
billion?
It was
9.7 billion is what Novartis acquired them for. So,
well, be fun to watch. Be definitely fun to watch. Well, Steve, Stephen, Lauren, thanks for joining today. Links to all the stories we discussed today can be found in the show notes. And don't miss the latest episode of the BioCentury Show. Editor-in-Chief Simone Fishburne, who is off today celebrating Passover, is in conversation with Bristol-Myers Head of Research, Robert Plenge. And they talk about all sorts of interesting topics, and you can watch that on our YouTube channel. Also on BioCentury, Lauren surveys new targets uncovered at AACR. And you'll also find our continued coverage of the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act on biopharma. Thanks for tuning in. Kendall Square Orchestra provides the music for BioCentury this week. The group connects science and technology professionals and other members of the Greater Boston community to collaborate, innovate, and inspire through music while supporting causes related to healthcare and education.
BioCentury would like to thank Jato Capital for its continued support of our BioCentury This Week podcast and our 24th annual BioEquity Europe Conference this May in San Sebastian.